Good afternoon. I'd like to call the committee to order. Good afternoon, everybody. We have a pretty ambitious agenda. Of course, as we get close to deadlines here, I think most people are probably aware that we're going to get as far as we can now in our regular committee time, and then we're going to recess and continue starting at 6 o'clock this evening. So we're going to, first of all, we've got some minutes. We do have a quorum. And Representative Franson, would you like to move the minutes?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to move the minutes.
All right. Thank you. Representative Franson moves the minutes of March 8, 2013. Is there any discussion to the minutes?
Thank you. I have a right.
Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you, Representative Franson. The minutes
You're welcome.
Are approved. So first bill up is House File 947, and that's my bill, and Representative Moran is going to take the gavel.
Okay, Representative Lieberman, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 947, and I believe I have a delete all.
Yeah.
Yep. And Madam Chair, I would like to, so that House File 947 be recommended to pass, and I think it goes to the General Register, no?
Okay.
Where does it go?
Judiciary.
To the Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
Okay.
So Representative Lieberman moves that House File 947 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Lieberman, could you move your amendment?
Right. Madam Chair, and I have a delete all amendment that I'd like to put on to get the bill in the order in which I'd like to have it discussed. And that is the 0199 amendment should be in members' packets, and so I would move the delete all amendment. If we could adopt that, then we can get to the substance of the bill.
Okay. Representative Lieberman moves the A-13-0199 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like it. All those in favor say
aye.
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 All those opposed?
Going well.
Okay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lieberman, go ahead and present your bill.
All right. Members, even though this bill is, it deals with the sometimes very volatile issue of sex offenders and civil commitments, but what you see before you is really a technical bill. It makes no substantive changes to the law. This came out of an OLA report, which, among other things, recommended separating the civil commitment statutes that apply to sex offenders and that apply to other folks who are mentally ill and dangerous. And so in the last legislature recommended to the department, or maybe required to the department, I'm not quite sure, but asked that this be done. And so we're back with the results of that, and it is very technical, and I'm going to ask my testifier to present it. And as you see on the bill, this is, I have a couple co-authors, and I really appreciate Representative Abler and Representative Cornish co-authoring this bill with me, because I'm hoping that it's just non-controversial and that it will just, and the purpose of this, members, is to, because this section of law is very confused between these two kinds of civil commitment, it's hard for practitioners to work with the law, and it also means that moving forward, any changes that we make, if we can get this enacted, future changes will be simply easier to manage and easier for everybody to see what we're doing and not make inadvertent changes to one side when we're really dealing with the other side. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier to walk you through the bill.
Okay. Could you please introduce yourself?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I am a Deputy General Counsel with the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Please go ahead.
And as Representative Liebling indicated, the bill that's before the members is the result of a recommendation from the legislative auditor that was followed up in the 2011 session with a requirement by the legislature that the Commission of Human Services review the existing law consultation with the reviser of statutes to recommend legislation, which you have before you, that clearly organizes the law and distinguishes it from laws relating to other forms of civil commitment. So it is certainly not intended to change anything substantive with the law, such as the standards for commitment or the standards for reductions in custody. There is some clarification that is done as part of the reorganization, and those clarifying items are described in the one- or two-page handout that members received that discusses some of the background and highlights items such as the terminology change of patient to committed person, using executive director rather than head of treatment facility. So those would be examples of not simply moving things around, but of providing clarification that distinguishes these statutes from statutes affecting other civil commitment populations. Now, the way that this bill works is kind of in several steps. The first group of sections, sections 1 through 8, prepare existing sections in 253B for renumbering. That's sections that need to have elements that are in both in 253B and in the new 253D. Sections 9 through 19 have a lot of underlining. Those look like a lot of new language. For the most part, though, those are replications of existing provisions within 253B that could not be renumbered and needed to exist in both 253B and 253D. So that language looks new, but it's not necessarily new to the statute. Sections 20 and 21 provide guidance to courts and others on the construction and application of these changes, particularly noting that there's no intent to substantively change the law as it exists for populations still covered by 253B. And Section 22 does the heavy lifting of renumbering and reorganizing the statutes, some of which were tweaked earlier on in the bill, others that can just be renumbered wholesale. So that is the quick guide to what this bill does.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is necessary to do. I was just kind of reading the annotated version, which I think could be come out in a movie someday. I was especially taken by line 821, where it describes the rights of patients or persons committed under this chapter. The reason for that is preparation for moving 253D to 253D.02. I thought that was really nice to know, so I really thank you for all that helpful annotated stuff. I'm being a little facetious, but these recodifications are really actually valuable. They clean up law so we can read them more clearly. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do you have any other questions by the members? Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I'm just wondering on just a couple quick questions. On page 14 and 15, the line is 14.27 and then 15.15, the striking of the word provisional discharge. I'm just wondering, does that fall in the category of you saying, you talked about some stuff looks new in there, it's not actually new. I'm wondering, is that that or why is that being struck from the language in those parts of the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that's an example of preparing existing language for its new place in 253D. When that subdivision is moved to 253D, it'll be part of several subdivisions relating to provisional discharge. So rather than provisional discharge being the title, it is the factors relating to provisional discharge that will be the substance of it when it's in that new location.
Representative May.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just one other question. If I understand you correctly, and Representative Liebling, this is doing nothing to necessarily create or change our civil commitment process, just create this new chapter of law. And so I guess in removing the sexually dangerous persons and the sexually psychopathic personalities, I'm trying to remember exactly what those acronyms stand for, and eliminating the cross-references, I'm just making sure that confident nothing's been forgotten and nothing is changing in the civil commitment process. This is just taking language from one section and moving into a new section in order to clean up what has gotten to be messy parts of state statute. Is that correct?
Mr. V. Benson?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mack, that is precisely correct. There is no substantive changes to how someone is civilly committed, the standards that are applied to that, nor to reductions in custody and the standards that are applied to that. This bill creates a working space for the legislature, if it were so inclined, to do some of that work, but it does not do that work.
Thank you. Representative Mack?
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the members? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against? Okay, seeing no further questions, Representative Liebling renews a motion that House File 947 be recommended to pass as amended and we refer to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Oh, pass.
Thank you. Thank you, members. Okay, next we're going to move to House File 573, Representative Ward. And while Representative Ward's coming up, let me just remind members that we heard the public testimony on this bill on Friday, so we're not taking any more public testimony today as such, but we have a number of amendments. And we will be discussing those, and I think Representative Ward and others may be answering questions as those are discussed. But we did our public testimony already. So, let's see. So I'm going to move Representative Ward's bill. I'm going to move that House File 573 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. So, welcome back, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
And do you want to just I'll give you maybe just a couple minutes to maybe get us back in the mood here, kind of remind us of what we've got before us, and away from the exciting topic we just finished.
Madam Chair, I'm always all about the mood, so anything.
Well, go ahead, Representative Ward. Sorry, I guess I caught you a little off guard there, but did you want to just remind us of what we're doing here today?
Well, House File 573, as we talked about last Friday, is a statewide health insurance bill for education employees to create a large pool to minimize premium increases to provide adequate, comprehensive, affordable health care for all of our educational employees in the state. And I'm sure we had a good discussion on Friday, and I'm looking forward to talking about the amendments.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ward. So, in the packet we have the A8 amendment. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What this the A8 amendment does is that it takes off the PEEP HSA, Health Savings Account, High Deductible Plan as an option. And as I mentioned last week, I always look at this bill in terms of how it treats all school district employees, not just the high-paid administrators, but the teachers and also the lunchroom lady and the paraprofessional and some people who don't even get to earn 8 hours a day on an government yet are paid on an hourly basis to make sure it works for them. And I think the high deductible policy is definitely not affordable for those lower income hourly workers within the school district. As for a single person, they would have to pay the first $5,000. First amount would have to be, they'd have to pay the first $1,500 to $4,000 in addition to their premium before the insurance would kick in. That's $1,500 to $4,000 before, plus their premiums, before their coverage kicks in. That's a lot of money. And it does have a limitation of a $5,000 total out-of-pocket plus the premium. But for a single person working those kind of hours at the kind of pay we know they get, that I think is not affordable. For the family, it's equally troublesome. And we all know families have kids that have, you know, get injured in the hockey game, or mom has problems with the pregnancy, or whatever the situation would be. In addition to their premiums, they would have to have an annual first dollar deductible of $3,000 to $8,000, depending upon what tier they selected, in addition to their premium, with a maximum of $10,000 a year. So if it was a typical quarter premium, and I tried to find on the web, but I couldn't find, based on the Moundsview information that was provided last time, it wouldn't be unusual if you had a 50-50 split of the premium with the employer that you'd pay about $7,000 as just your premium out of your monthly paycheck. Or weekly, depending on how you're paid. In addition to that, you could pay, be obligated to spend up to $10,000 with, like I say, the first dollar deductible being $3,000 to $8,000. I don't think that's affordable for many of our school district employees, so I would like to take this option off the table. That still lets the other two options within the PEAT program be available to our school districts, and I think they're more suitable for the range of public employees that we have within our school districts. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, how much is the premium in that policy you're referring to? That part of the policy?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson. That's information I tried to get off the website. I couldn't get. Based on the information that we got at the last hearing from Moundsview School District, it looks like for a family high deductible policy, it would be about $1,200 a month. But that would be split between the employer and the employee, and I wasn't able to get a hold of Mr. Morocco to get any specific numbers. But it's typical that a family deductible premium is about $15,000 a year, so that feels sort of in the range to me, but I can't speak to that. And I did try to get that information. I was hoping Mr. Morocco was here so he could actually give us that number. But I think, let's just assume it's a little less, because it's a high deductible, it's a little less than an average premium, but you still are, after you pay your premiums, like I say, you'd be responsible for that first $3,000 to $8,000 if you were in a family policy in addition to your premium, and that is on their website. That is a firm number. Or if you were a single, it was a single policy, it would be the first $1,500 to $4,000 in addition to your premium. And that, you know, given the budgets that I know many school district employees have, I just think that's too high. The other two options are a better blending of less high cost shifting onto the employee.
Representative Ward, do you want to respond? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson. Go ahead, Representative
Let me
Johnson.
Just expand this a little bit. I would like to know what a typical premium is. I understand there's three options, am I correct, under the bill as written? And I would like to know what is the premium for those. Frankly, it's possible that this would be a very wise choice. I've been a member in one of those plans. It was a rational choice for me when I had low income and I was young and relatively healthy. And so, but I would like to know before I vote on this bill, what can I anticipate the premium to be for these? Because this is an issue in a larger context. I appreciate, Representative Loeffler, your concern about the lower wage employees. I share that concern because I've heard with some frequency that those who are part-time workers or lower-wage employees in our schools are going to have trouble with paying these premiums, and that's a that's a legitimate concern.
Okay, Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. And Representative Loeffler, thank you for talking to me prior to the hearing about your concerns. We had a good dialogue and good talk, and I respect and appreciate the conversation that we had. You know, while nobody can predict the future, especially with healthcare, especially with healthcare insurance, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with any healthcare at this point. But we do know we can base our information on what, you know, has happened in the past. And so we have some data on that. And I would ask one of my testifiers to touch base on part of your questions.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Courtney Derwinski, and I am a negotiation specialist with Education Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, so thank you for your questions. When people decide to go into the PEEP program, one of the advantages is that it provides a lot of choice, and among those choices is the various levels of plans that are available. So there is the Advantage plan, which we sometimes call the high, the value option, and the HSA compatible option. About over 20% of members that have gone into PEEP have decided that the HSA compatible option is the right one for them. Often they make that decision based on affordability considerations because the premiums are significantly often less than the Advantage or the value option. So, and the other piece of this is with high deductible plans where they are paying a higher amount upfront out of pocket, we would, you know, often negotiate employer contributions towards that deductible. So the amount of the deductible doesn't always represent, you know, exactly what is coming out of members' pockets. So I appreciate your question. The other thing I would note also is that in different parts of the state, there are very similar plans to this one that have high deductible option components. And so this plan would be appropriate for those districts that have very similar plans to this one. So that's why we believe it's an important part of the PEEP program. And our members, you know, have voted more or less with their decision to go into it by the numbers that have also enrolled in the HSA compatible option.
Okay, other members on the list, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, my question wasn't really answered.
Oh,
I would like to know what I'd appreciate knowing a ballpark cost, premium cost, for, again, I understand there's three levels of plans, and use an example or last year's data, but I think if we're going to talk about, you know, once you get into the, it's going to cost this and cost that, then you need to know the entire cost. Now I'm acting as a consumer. If I'm going to buy a plan, I'm going to want to know that. And so can you get me a ballpark cost on the three levels of the plan? And you say there's multiple options. I want to be clear. There's three options. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. That's the information I'm requesting. I think it relates to this amendment.
Okay. And Representative Ward?
Madam Chair, the best I can do is we can try to get that information in the future. I don't have that information with me today, and we can try to get it in the future. I don't see Mr. Morocco here at all either, so that's the best I can do is try to get it to you in the future. I know that doesn't help for today, Representative Johnson, but your point is well taken. And, you know, Representative Loeffler's point about this plan is difficult for the, as you say, as you have said, Representative Loeffler, for the cafeteria folks and, you know, the ESP folks as well. So let's have further dialogue.
Okay, on the list, on the amendment, Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, is this just on maybe Representative Johnson's point, is this going to finance too? And that's
Representative Schoen, in my understanding, is it's got several stops to make. It is going to go to finance at some point.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, to the amendment. I share Representative Loeffler's angst of the high deductible health care plan as a single parent who has a couple kids on or was on one of those, it was one of the worst things ever designed as far as I was concerned at that point. But when I didn't have my kids on there, there was some good reasons to be on it. And my only concern with your amendment here is, well, there's multiple, but if a district is self-insured, I would assume that they can offer any plan they want, and it would be the same, so we're not capturing those folks amongst this amendment, and I'm not sure that maybe we should, because it's tying them a little bit more than even maybe I would like to, and I would like high deductible plans to go away altogether. So I guess how do we, and if there's just no money for it and this is the only plan available, then how do we, you know, I think it's a pretty big grab, and it kind of concerns me, but what is I just want to make it very clear, what are the teachers and the folks that are going to participate in this think about that particular amendment then?
Oh, Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, members, and again, Representative Loeffler and I had good conversation about this, and if the members want to vote for this, members, I'm fine with it. You know, so okay. I'll just leave it at that.
All right, we've got Representative Grunhagen, and then Representative Loeffler wants to finish up with a conversation, and then we'll vote on the amendment. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I sell health insurance and for about 30 some years. And, you know, I identify Representative Schoen's comments and also the testifier from Education Minnesota is that, you know, people have the ability to weigh the consequences of the plan that they're selecting. And like Representative Schoen said, in one situation, when he was single and healthy, it turned out to be a good deal for him. And in the next one, he realized that that probably wasn't the plan. One thing about higher deductible plans, you generally, from an industry standpoint, you get lower utilization, okay? And as long as your preventative is covered up front. And one of the problems with lower deductible copay plans is you get higher utilization. And ultimately that drives up your cost inside the plan. So to take this away as a choice, I guess I would not support it, because I think ultimately they're going to be given a number of choices, according to the testimony from Education Minnesota, within the PEEP plan already. So why take this choice away when there's some positive things for certain individuals, regardless of where their employment is, that they could benefit from this type of a plan? And I understand where Representative Loeffler is coming from. And I respectfully disagree with that. And I think by giving them an additional choice, you'll meet the needs of the employees better, and you might reduce unnecessary utilization of the plan, which, to a certain degree, which could actually keep premiums more reasonable for the group as a whole. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Loeffler, final word on the amendment, and
yeah,
then we'll vote on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think there's been a little bit of confusion, and I think we do need to remember that when people can't meet their deductibles, it's uncompensated care, it's medical bankruptcy, it's serious consequences, and none of us can predict the future. Any one of us could be in a car accident on the way home, even if we're healthy and young and work out every day at the gym. And so that's the whole purpose of insurance. The other options, I just want to let you know, if you're worried about they don't have enough choices, the other choices under Advantage Health Plan for a family, maximum out-of-pocket is premium plus $3,800. Okay, the value option is premium plus a maximum of $6,000 out of pocket. That is still taking on risk in order to keep a reasonable premium. I just think that premium plus $10,000 is just too much. And so I just want to take the highest cost option off, because I do think it leads to uncompensated care, which is rising insurance rates for all the rest of us, and it's just not suitable, I don't think, for many of our school district employees. So there's clearly affordable other options. The other two options are there. But I think this, you know, paying your premiums and then potentially still having $10,000 of obligation is more than I'm comfortable to step up with for our school district employees. I think they expect us to give them a better deal than maybe they were able to get in their own negotiations before, and I think these two plans will do a better job than that third option.
Okay, all those in favor of the A8 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have the A12 amendment. Is that yours as well? That's also mine.
Mm-hmm. And this is the one that provides that right now the bill says that anyone with 1,000 lives, if they're self-insured, have the opt-out. And this just says any school district with 1,000 lives can opt out. And what that does is it says that school districts that are fully insured, that's in the regular market, they're contributing to MCHA, they're contributing to the funding for Minnesota Care, do not get punished for that choice. I think this committee and I in particular really appreciate the fact that we have Minnesota Care and that it has been a safety net for a lot of working Minnesotans, and that MCHA has been available to people with really serious health conditions. And so this amendment just says all school districts that have over 1,000 lives have the same choice, and that we're not going to punish those who happen to participate in the full market.
Mm-hmm. Okay, questions to the amendment? None. Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, you know, I'm concerned about adverse selection and, you know, having the largest size pool that we can in order to do what we want to do, what we need to do for our school district employees. So I would just ask members to consider that, you know, vote the way you want to, members.
Okay. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just remind members that under the Affordable Care Act, no pre-existing conditions are to be used in weighting things, so our old concepts of adverse selection are really changing. There's still some options, but the ones that we used to think about in terms of you get someone who's needed a transplant or whatever in your pool are really taken care of by the Affordable Care Act.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Loeffler. Am I understanding your amendment correctly that this will allow a larger group to opt out of the PEEP program if they choose?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Zerwas, the bill currently, as it's before us, allows groups with 1,000 lives to opt out if they're self-insured. This just says if you have 1,000 lives, you get to, with your representatives, decide whether or not to opt out. It just takes the full group.
And I guess I'd like to ask a question probably of Representative Ward or maybe Ms. Allschwager. So how many school districts are we talking about here that would be self-insured? What pool size are we talking about that now could potentially opt out fully insured, that if we were to adopt this amendment, what's the impact on the overall pool? Ms. Allschwager.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allschwager, Education Minnesota. I believe when we calculated 1,000 lives, we used that figure, and as we understand it, the insurance industry thinks of one employee as having 2.4 insured lives. So if you're looking at 1,000 lives, if I'm understanding this amendment correctly, that you're looking at about 416 people, 0.6666. And so we don't have the number of school districts across the state that are not self-insured that would meet that threshold. We're not prepared for that today. We could certainly try to find out through the Department of Education. But it would be the school districts that have about 416 employees. And to give you an idea, Hopkins is one of those districts that I think they're at about 1,010 insured lives, I believe. So that kind of gives you an idea about how big a district is.
Okay. Other questions, members, to the amendment? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just conversing with Representative Morgan over here. Am I missing something? And I could be mistaken. If I line up the we're on the A-12 amendment, correct?
We're on the A-12. That's correct.
I'm just lining up the language, page 4, line 14. And I just don't see those words anywhere in line 14 that we're deleting. But do I have a wrong version of the bill? This was in my packet, but I maybe have a wrong version. I'm sorry.
You may, Representative Mack. Okay. I do see it in my version. Are you on 573?
I am, yep, the one that was in my packet. I apologize, Madam Chair. I'll get the right one.
Okay, so... Members, as I've with the bill that's in my hands, if with the amendment, that line on page 4, that 414 would read, the school board of a school employer, not including a service cooperative under section 123A.21, with 1,000 or more insured lives on the day of enactment, and each exclusive representative of employees of that school employer shall jointly determine whether the employees represented by the exclusive representative will opt out of the program. So it's taking out the individually self-insured. Other questions, members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chairman, this is Chairwoman. This may be a naive question of a newbie, but I want to make sure I understand self-insured. Would somebody, a school employer that is self-insured, could somebody give me a definition of that? I understand that as a school district that has, for instance, a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan.
No.
Madam
Chair, I can explain.
And, well, actually, I think I'd ask our testifiers to explain that. Ms. Is it Dewinsky? Did I get it?
Yes. Courtney Dewinsky.
Dewinsky. Can you explain that?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. A self-funded plan is a plan where the employer is paying the claims out of their assets, as opposed to a fully insured plan where you're purchasing insurance through an insurance company, they're paying the premium, and the insurance company bears the risk of that plan.
Okay, Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, it's a huge topic, and all these, if the company or school board in this case is self-insured, they are protected by federal laws called ERISA. Don't ask me what ERISA stands for, and which means the state cannot regulate those. And you may think you have a regular insurance, and if you're on CGIP, I don't know which. I have a Blue Cross Blue Shield card, but Blue Cross Blue Shield simply manages the state's employees in this plan, and the state is responsible for any expenses that the employees gather. So the insurance part of it is the company itself. The company is at risk. If they have huge costs, a lot of sick people, then the company, or in this case the school board, pays that, not the insurance company. The insurance company only manages the bills going back and forth.
Okay. Representative Albright.
For the author of the bill. Representative Ward, by the insertion, or excuse me, to Representative Loeffler. By the insertion.
Representative Albright, excuse me, I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you put your mic down a little bit? And I know you have a soft voice sometimes.
I do.
I want the people in the far rows to hear you.
Speaks to my demure, you know, temperament.
He's hard to hear sometimes.
Representative, when I look at line 5.1 and I look at the inclusion of the word insured as opposed to self-insured, it strikes me that we are playing favorites. And I say that from the context of, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it would give choice only to those that have 1,000 covered lives or more. So in the context of, as we heard testimony from two school districts last week, and I don't recall the total number of lives that were covered under those two examples, but you would force them into a choice that is not of their own doing. And as I recall, the competitive bid process that they underwent actually provided them with a better pricing point than PEEP afforded them.
Yeah. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. My change does not change what is in the underlying bill. The underlying bill, as it's presented to us, does give a choice to those with 1,000 or more lives if they're self-insured. This, my amendment only says if you have over 1,000 lives, whether you're self-insured or fully insured, you get the choice. So everybody with 1,000 or more lives has a choice. That does not change how the bill in any way treats anyone underneath. But I do think that the large school districts should not be punished and excluded from a choice just because they chose to be in the fully insured market rather than taking on the risk of being self-insured.
Representative Albright, does that answer the question? She's treating the fully insured and the self-insured the same. In other words, she's giving more districts the option to opt out, is what she's doing here.
I understand.
Representative Albright.
Bear with me, Representative Loeffler, then. School employers may opt out only if the total insured lives remain after implying clauses 2 and 4 is more than 1,000 lives. So give me an example of a school district who has 750 employees, insured lives, and has their insurance not with PEEP. Would they still be able to use that alternative source for their insurance, or would they be forced to use PEEP?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, that's a question to the substance of the bill and Representative Ward. My amendment does not affect anyone under 1,000 lives. It only tries to level the playing field for those who are above 1,000.
Right. Representative Albright, I think
between insured and self-insured.
Your concern here, I think, is more to the bill than to the amendment, I think, because I hear you.
I just want to make sure that insured, from a definition, words have meaning, speaks to, is at a broader context than what we are talking about in the bill, or should it refer to either self-insured or insured based upon the risk that a group that size is willing to take on or not take on?
Okay. I think I understand what you're saying, Representative Albright. Maybe the word insured there isn't the right. I think we're talking about if the total covered lives remain.
Thank you.
Correct? So, Representative Loeffler, would covered rather be a better than insured? I understand now where Representative Albright is going.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I have always relied on our House counsel and to do amendments when they understand what the intent is. If, you know, it could be self-insured and fully insured plans if you would like. If you felt like that was more clear, my understanding of insurance usage is insured means both. But Mr. Chun, who drafted this, I believe, or else Mr. Pender out of House Research, aren't in the room yet, and they understood that I wanted both fully insured and self-insured to be covered the same, and this is the word they chose.
Let's ask Ms. Cleveland here. Maybe she can shed some light on this. Ms. Cleveland, can you help us out?
Madam Chair and members, I think if your intent is to say covered lives, I think that insured does the same thing, but either word could work.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And from experience in the insurance industry, from a broader context, the insured might not include self-insured, and so I would appreciate if there would be an opportunity to just replace insured with covered.
Representative Loeffler, you're the author of the amendment, and I think you'll have the final word on that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Unless we hear an amendment to the amendment.
Having consulted with the House research experts who actually know how state law defines it, which is oftentimes different than what common usage in an industry is. I'm more comfortable at this point to stay with their suggested language, but I will be glad to follow up and ask them your question. And since it's going to other committees, I will pass on the information to Representative Ward. But I think we can get this clarified. I'm just not the lawyer, but I trust their judgment.
Okay, and we're going to go to Representative Mack, and then we're going to vote on the amendment. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a brief question of clarification, Representative Loeffler. On Friday when we were discussing this, we clarified that districts can opt out if they meet the insured lives threshold, if they're self-insured, and now if your amendment went on, also fully insured. And then if the exclusive representation agreed to opt out. And I clarified with Representative Ward last week that that was a piece of it, that they could still only opt out, even if they met all those other criteria, they could still only opt out if the union or exclusive representative agreed and said, yes, we can opt out. And so I'm just making sure that that one piece, that key piece still, so now if this amendment went on, we said fully insured as well as self-insured, and you meet the number threshold, could opt out if the exclusive representative signs off on it. Is that correct? This amendment does nothing to change that one piece, that the exclusive representative would still hold a fair amount of the cards in terms of the ultimate result.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I do not change the underlying language, although I think it's important to note under 5.5, it's may negotiate with the exclusive representative, so there's a negotiation process there.
Okay. Representative Ward, I'm going to give you the final word, then we're going to vote.
Madam Chair, just a point to Representative Mack's point. Just to clarify, 1,000 insured lives, self-insured, and if the amendment goes fully insured, and then exclusive rep and employer have to both agree. Not just the exclusive rep and the employer have to agree in order to opt out. I just wanted to clarify that so that...
Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
And just briefly to that point, I appreciate the clarification. I guess my concern is, in the case of my school district, if there's a situation the employer, the district, is saying something like this, the contracts they get do not make financial sense for them, yet they are in disagreement with their union representation in this, that would put the district in a difficult situation financially. If they know financially it's not a good move for them, but they can't come to agreement with their union, they might be put in a situation. So that's my concern, right. And I just want to clarify.
The amendment doesn't touch that. Okay, we've got the A-12 amendment before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We're on the A-10 amendment. Who's got the A-10? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A-10 amendment, basically, it is pretty self-explanatory. On page 5, line 2, after the word lives, we insert this phrase, or if the school employer has received a bid from a source of coverage that provides coverage that is less expensive for equivalent service coverage than coverage available from the program. The reason I'm introducing this bill is obvious. There are a number of districts, including those that I represent, that have been able to negotiate coverage which would be superior to, or has been superior to, what could be offered or potentially offered under this bill, and those districts would like to keep that option. And I think it would be difficult for members of this committee to vote positively to increase expense for districts that are achieving a better result on their own. Now, I understand, and I think the folks in these districts that I represent ought to understand that they could find themselves in a problem if they have a whole series of major health crises that hit their employees. They can expect they're going to be seeing a change in that coverage in the future. But apparently they're willing to take the chance, and I'm prepared to
and willing to help them take the chance. So, Madam Chair, that's the purpose of my amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Benson. Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, I've looked at this amendment, and my concern with this amendment, members, is that, you know, somebody said it at the hearing on Friday, you know, oftentimes there's a peak bid, and then all of a sudden an insurance company comes in with a lower bid, and it usually comes in with a lower bid for a couple different reasons. Maybe it, you know, doesn't match up the benefits or the coverage or things as such. And somebody said, you know, where have they been? Where have the insurance companies been? And I ask that same thing right now. You know, a lot of times they'll come in, the insurance companies will come in with a lower bid on a one-time basis using the reserve fund, just, you know, to get the bid, and then after that, We've seen the results of what happens after that, and that's why we have House File 573. So I would oppose this amendment, Madam Chair, and members.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that does happen, Representative Ward. I served on a negotiating committee, and that's exactly what happened. An insurance company did come in and offer a lower bid. We accepted it, and then pretty soon, the next time it came up, they jacked up the premiums. Then we went to a different company. And as I said before, I think the districts that school districts that I represent understand that those kinds of things happen. They've been involved in negotiations for insurance for 20, 30, 40 years now. That is a good point, and it should be on the record, and I agree that that very well could happen. But in spite of that, my feel is every opportunity I have to allow my local school districts or local communities or cities or counties to make decisions, as long as they're prepared to accept the consequences, then I attempt to support local control, and I see that as an example of this. So, but your point is well taken; cannot be argued against.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would just simply say I strongly support Representative Benson's amendment. I think it's healthy for school districts to have that type of option and not just be locked into one choice and forced to accept the benefits and premium increases within that. I think we've seen in other states that that type of an approach, which this bill takes, does not work very well. And it ultimately creates higher cost and problems for local districts in terms of meeting their budget and providing health insurance in the most cost-effective way. So I would strongly encourage a yes vote for Representative Benson's amendment. Thank you, Ms.
Okay. So, okay, and seeing no other questions, we'll vote on the A-10 amendment. So all in favor of the A-10 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
No. The motion does not prevail.
Division.
Division has been requested. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. All opposed? Are you opposed? Are you voting? Seven. Okay, are there abstentions? Okay, so on a vote of 9-7, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. The A-13. Who's got the A-13?
Madam Chair, I withdraw that amendment at the time.
Oh, Representative Albright. He withdraws it. Okay, thank you. I can't hear you. Sorry.
Speak up, buddy.
The A-14.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Withdraw this amendment at the time as well.
the A-15.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I withdraw this amendment.
A-16.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwatz.
At this time, we'll withdraw this one as well.
Okay. The A-16 is withdrawn. A-17.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, having been in the benefits field for a number of years, I think it's normal and customary that when a group visits or revisits the issue of the nature and costing for their employee benefits, particularly in this case insurance, with regard to the dynamics that are being played out with the ACA and a number of other features, this amendment moves to strike the two-year requirement and moves it to a one-year contract.
Okay, Representative Albright, I assume then that you're going to move the A-17?
Yes, okay. I am, Madam Chair.
All right.
I wish to move
that
A-17 amendment.
Okay. All right, so Representative Albright moves the A-17. Discussion to the amendment. Okay, Representative Ward. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Huntley has a... we'll go to Representative Ward and then Representative Huntley.
Members, most contracts, health insurance contracts, are for a two-year period. The Affordable Care Act, as I said on Friday, we are, this bill and the Affordable Care Act, health insurance exchange bill, are moving side by side. Representative Atkins and I have had many talks about that. Individual district contracts are two-year contracts as well. And so, I would ask that we keep this as a two-year contract for those reasons, and I would oppose this amendment.
Okay. All right. Representative Huntley. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Ward said pretty much what I was going to say, but if you have to redo and reapply and all that, there's a lot of administrative costs that go along with that, so this would double the administrative cost of setting up this program. So I would vote no.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion to the A-17 amendment? All right. Seeing none, we're going to vote on this then. All those in favor of the A-17, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
No. No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. The A-18 amendment. Does anybody have the A-18?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I wish to withdraw this amendment at the time.
Okay, Representative Albright withdraws the A-18. The A-19.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I wish to move the A-19 amendment.
All right, Representative Albright moves the A-19 amendment. To the amendment, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a straightforward amendment that provides every school district with an opportunity to entertain a competitive bid process with regard to their insurance. It follows on to the assertion by Representative Benson's amendment, but it tweaks it a little bit from the standpoint that one of the competitive bids needs to be an entity other than from the PEEP.
Okay. Any discussion? I don't know if Representative Ward has had an opportunity to look at this.
Madam Chair, I have not had an opportunity to look at this one. So I'm just looking at it now, Madam Chair. If you want to entertain some questions, I'll weigh in a minute.
Okay. I'm not seeing any. Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it would be useful if the author of the amendment would explain what he's deleting. We can see what the new language is, but there's a lot of deletion here.
Good idea. Representative Albright, if you would.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some would argue it might not delete enough, but on page 2, it deletes section 2, which goes to the point of the board of discerning the choices. Sorry, Madam Chair, the amendment does not include the part of Section 2 on the top of page 3. I apologize for that oversight.
Could you clarify that, Representative Albright? What do you mean it doesn't include it? What do you, please try
on
again.
Section
here.
2, on starting on line 2.19. My copy shows that it goes on to the top of page 3 through page 3 point, or line 3.8.
Okay. And Representative Albright, you are working off the first engrossment, correct? You're matching up with what I've got in front of me.
Okay.
But it is the first engrossment.
Right. And then page 4, it's deleting lines 5 through 36 and replacing it with the language on the amendment of 1.4 through 1.7.
Right. Well, Representative Albright, I think we can all read what the amendment is deleting, but what we're asking you is what in fact are you intending to do to the bill here, if you could just explain that to us.
Purely and simply to provide every school district with an opportunity to have a competitive bid process with at least one of the choices provided to the school district of a non-PEEP variety.
So, Representative Albright, maybe you could just kind of tell us what's left of the bill after your amendment, if your amendment would go on.
Section 1.
So that's the definitions.
Then we replace Section 2 with lines 1.4 through 1.7. On page 5, all is removed.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
All is removed.
All of page 5?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative Albright, what I'm understanding here, and maybe other members can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me it basically replaces this bill with another bill that just says that...
Replaces it with the competitive bid process.
Right, that would require every school district to have a competitive bid process for health and coverage. And what I would ask you is, what about the ones that don't offer any? Would you be requiring them to now offer and have a competitive bid process?
They have the choice of going through a competitive bid process or not.
Well, Representative Albright, I don't know if other members are, your language here
if
is...
If they're providing, Madam Chair, if they're providing coverage, then the competitive bid process would take place.
Okay, so Representative Albright, in the what would be left of the bill with your amendment, where does it say that if they're offering coverage?
That's a good question, Madam Chair.
So as I'm reading it, maybe staff can help us here. I don't know if it would be Ms. Cleveland. Ms. Cleveland, can you kind of tell us what would be the bill if this amendment went on?
Madam Chair and members, if the A-19 went on, you'd be left with the definitions, and then the replaced language of a new paragraph G, essentially under the public employee participation section, which requires what the language, you know, as it's here on the bill or on the amendment.
Okay, so I'm understanding it. Representative Albright's amendment then is going to require every school district to get competitive bids for health insurance, and I understand that to apply to whether they currently offer or not, or whatever their current arrangement is. This would require that.
Representative
Albright.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer an oral amendment to my amendment.
Okay, go ahead.
On line 1.4, it should begin by saying, if group insurance is offered by the school district, comma, every 2 years, each independent, and it would go on from there.
Okay, did everybody get that? So Representative Albright is incorporating the following language on page 1.4 after G. He's inserting, if group insurance is offered by the school district. Is that correct, Representative Albright?
Yes,
okay,
Madam Chair.
He's incorporating that change. Okay, I think we're ready to vote on this amendment. So on the A-19, all those in favor of the A-19 as amended or as with the incorporated change, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
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 The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, the DE-1.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the DE-1 amendment.
All right, Representative Zerwas moves the DE-1 amendment.
All right, thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
On Friday when we were discussing this, one of the things that struck me was the comment about instead of, you know, we have the ACA and the health exchange bill that's working its way through, that we'll have administrative costs. We have this bill, which has a premium surcharge for the first several years to set up administrative pay for administrative costs and administrative charges, and it was brought up about CGIP, the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, and someone made the comment, you know, you wouldn't want those people as a part of CGIP, and I think we absolutely would open up CGIP, especially to our school districts that are having trouble with competitive bids because their pool just isn't big enough. And so my thought is, instead of reinventing the wheel and coming up with premium surcharges to pay for an administrative backbone for a new program, why not just insert language that would allow these districts to obtain employee group health coverage through the State Employee Group Insurance Plan? It's already established. It's already set up. It already functions. Why not just open the door a little bit wider?
Okay. Comments, Representative Ward?
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, thank you.
You're welcome.
However.
Oh. I thought I had it.
However, Representative Zerwas. Members, this, you know, this basically, you know, replaces CGIP. You know, it doesn't allow our members to go into PEEP if this bill passes, you know, thereby taking away some of the decision-making by them, some of the benefits that people, they get from PEEP on that. So, members, I'm just going to oppose this. I appreciate the amendment. I appreciate your offer. PEEP has established a record of very good health insurance coverage for their members, and that's the program that we've selected in order to move forward with this bill. Thank you, members.
Okay, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ward, just to clarify your statements, could you explain to me what they have access to under PEEP that CGIP wouldn't provide them or wouldn't afford them, the advantages that you mentioned that come under PEEP? Could you explain that to me?
Ms. Dewinsky.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, there are within PEEP different plan design options that don't exist in the CGIP program, and the purpose of that is just that there's a wider variety of plan needs in the school districts in the state.
Okay, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to clarify, I don't know the numbers of how many are in PEEP versus how many are in CGIP, but are you saying that there's a unique need or case mix or within the teachers and folks that districts would be putting into PEEP versus the wide variety of issues and needs that exist in CGIP across all state employees? There's a unique set of needs within this pool of people. Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Dewinsky or Ms. Alschwager?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, the reason that you need that middle level plan for school employees is because the school, many school employees could never afford to go into a plan like the one you have because their premiums are so expensive, they have been ill, they don't have the community in their pool that is well enough to afford a richer benefit. And so if you look at the benefit sets across the state in the districts, you will find a lot of them that cannot even consider jumping to the benefit plan that you have because it would be too costly. Many of them have the HSAs, or if they were to go into PEEP, some of them would choose the middle plan.
Okay. All right, I think we're ready to vote on
Madam
the BE1. Who's Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think with the changes with the ACA, I think the pre-existing conditions we know and we've talked about on Friday that isn't a factor in the costing of this anymore, and so we want to make sure we're accurate on that. And as we look out, I want to think, what are we trying to accomplish here? Are we saying that we can't provide these small districts don't have a large enough pool, and so we want to provide them a large enough pool? Then I say we have CGIP and they can jump in, because it's a big enough pool, everyone can go swimming. But if we're looking at creating a new bureaucracy and a new thing to manage, then I think that's the direction that this bill goes. So what's the goal? Is it to provide more coverage? Because if it is, I think CGIP can do it, and it can do it efficiently.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, this would certainly put a fiscal note on this bill. And so it's going to have to go to some finance committee. I'm not sure which one. CGIP is paid entirely by us. And if there's additional cost because of adding the public school systems to CGIP, somebody's going to have to pay for it in their budget this year.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Huntley. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chairwoman and Representative Zerwas, I'm intrigued by this idea because I think the whole idea is to create a large pool, and I am a longtime member of CGIP. I'm pleased with that, and I think the opportunity to expand it to include all public employees in the state has merit and deserves a look. And I'm a little, I'll be honest, I'm frustrated with the process. I've been here, what, 3 or 4 weeks? Well, this is my frustration with the process in that I consistently see us racing to make a decision, and I'm told I have to accept that. But here's a possibility where a better idea is presented, but it needs time. It's a lot more complicated than this because it's not only the issues that Representative Huntley mentioned about there's a possibility of cost. The negotiation process for this plan is significantly different than what I perceive the negotiation process would be with PEIP, in that the negotiation process is done with representatives of multiple unions that are state unions. And I don't think it would be fair to ask Ed Minnesota or the other unions associated with public schools to have their plan totally negotiated by state unions. The second thing is, and this is where I think that we might be missing a boat on, is that as a public employee, the health care negotiation is pulled out of our contracts by this agreement. It's a separate thing. We don't get bogged down in the health care discussion. The health care discussion of our contracts is really quite separate. And frankly, I see that as an advantage to the bargaining process. I think there's some hope with that also with PEIP, but the additional choices that I'm perceiving, I'm careful with my language because it's hard to grasp it all, but there's some of that, but the choices that are demanded by different districts paying different percentages and different roles, they're not afforded to that, whereas as state employees, we are afforded that. My point being is that there's an advantage with this, and I really compliment you. I think there's a good idea here. I'm interested in large pools. I'm interested in clean processes that embrace as many workers in Minnesota as possible. I'm even open to the idea of expanding plans beyond the public employees. Can we get to a point where we can have a Minnesota care insurance that would really absorb the entire pool of this state? Can we do this really creatively? I'm arriving late. I think the horse has left the barn, and I may be way out in another look on it, but I do want to recognize this as a possibility. My other frustration that I do want to say is that when this is presented to me, you know, I saw this for the first time, I understood this now I got to vote on it. There's no really good way to absorb what that means. So it's very hard to support this kind of a change when the bill has come in this well-studied and well-prepared. And I would just hope that as we're working with these decisions, these affect the real lives of real people and their health care, that we somehow find a way that when we get a creative idea like this, to absorb it in the process far earlier so it can be examined, can be considered, and we might come up with a much better product. This is my moment to share that frustration. It's been building over several weeks. I don't think we'll change it, but I got to share it. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Johnson, and you could always file a bill, and that Representative Zerwest can file a bill, and this is essentially a different bill. Representative Benson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question to Representative Zerwatz. It's been my understanding that teachers are just about the last group anybody else wants to be in a pool with. And the reason is they have a lot of health problems. I spent 35 years in a classroom, and I can understand. I did escape with most of my health. But a lot of people don't. Have you talked to the other work groups or unions who would be part of this pool that you're suggesting, whether they want teachers in? I don't think they do.
Representative Zerwas, and he was on the list as well, so why don't you finish up and then we'll vote on this amendment.
Fantastic. Thank you, Madam Chair. And real briefly, Representative Benson, I think our goal should be to provide as cost-effective and effective health care for as many people as possible. And I don't see teachers as the lepers of the insurance market that you may. I think I was in through 1993 to about 1996. I had 4 heart surgeries in 3 years and waited for a heart transplant. Trust me, the city of Elk River switched insurance plans quite often. My family was the leper of the city of Elk River's insurance plan. But that's because we had a small pool. We had a group of under, I think it was at that time, about 65 employees for the city of Elk River that were a part of that insurance pool. That's where the issue comes from, is the small pool. I think if we open this up, and we have to think of what our goal is. Is our goal to provide effective, efficient, affordable health care to as many people, or is it to give something, some group a wedge in a union negotiation? Because we can give them a big hammer and an anvil and let them bang on each other, and we might get to good health care. Or we can open up the systems we already have and say, we can take care of everyone. And we can do it efficiently, and we can do it cost-effectively. That's I think, we have to step back and say, what are we trying to accomplish?
All right, we're going to vote on the DE1 amendment, and I think that's, in fact, what this bill is trying to do. The underlying bill is trying to get some efficiencies here. So all in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We have one more amendment, and that is the A9.
Madam Chair, I would like to withdraw that amendment.
All right. Representative Benson withdraws that amendment. We are on the House File 573 as amended, and I'm going to renew the motion that House File 573 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. So, Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question for the author, and this is back to something we talked about on Friday. I was thinking about it and wanted clarification. One thing we had talked about was the interaction of the exchange and this bill and a lot moving forward with a lot of unknowns. And one thing that you had mentioned at the time was that this, unlike the exchange, could provide, I think the word you said, because I jotted it down, is immediate relief or immediate help to the districts that need it most. But as I look at this bill, it's enacted on January 1st of 2014, the same time that the exchange is. So I guess I just wanted clarification on that. On that comment, it didn't make sense as I mulled it over later on. I guess it just gets back to my issue of why do this when we already have the exchange moving forward, and if your response was correct and that's what you meant, I guess I'm just looking for clarification.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mack. What I meant by that, Representative Mack, was that, you know, what in this bill does take enactment in January 1st of 2014. The State Healthcare Exchange also does, but it does not allow large school groups in at that point until 2017, another 3 years later. So we have 3 years where we have some potential savings for our educational employees and our state and our taxpayers, maybe even invest in education again. Wouldn't that be wonderful? So that's a clarification on that, and I appreciate it. I also, Madam Chair, I might,
Representative
Mack, if you have a follow-up, I'll get to it in a minute. But, I'm interested in Representative Benson's comments about nobody wants the teachers, probably because Representative Benson, they have heart attacks and things like that you're familiar with. In all seriousness, I would like to see, where that kind of documentation is and that says, educators are, at a bad risk or whatever. When we make statements like that, I think that we need to, make sure that that's validated as well. So, Representative Mack, I hope that clarified your point as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. That does clarify it. I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask for a roll call on the bill.
Okay, there will be a roll call. So Representative Grunhagen also had his hand up. I'm going to take your comment. I'm going to let Representative Ward finish, and then we're going to vote. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a couple quick questions. One, I appreciate, just a comment first. I appreciate Representative Benson's amendment. I hope it can stay in the bill through conference if it gets that far. Secondly, and I guess I'd address this to the author. Could you leave a massive unfunded liability in the general fund if losses are excessive inside the PEEP program? Who backs up the losses if it has a bad year, or one of the testifiers?
Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, part of that answer is... There may need to be some premium increases to pay for some of the losses or whatever. You never know. I came from a district that had a catastrophic event. Representative Zirwas talked about that. We had a football coach that had an aneurysm on the first football game of the year that was catastrophic to our pool. And so part of it would and so we had to learn how to. Make sure that our insurance pool, that our insurance coverage, covered that as well as the rest of us. And so, through some reserves, perhaps through some surcharge, we hope not, but perhaps there is a clause in there about borrowing from the insurance trust that would need to be paid back. So. Nobody can predict the future. We never knew that coach was going to have an aneurysm on the sideline and was as of retirement age at that point. So we hope that never happens to anybody, but we have put some measures in this bill to try to address those concerns.
Madam Chair.
Okay, we're going to finish, Representative Gruenhagen. We're out of time now. So we're going to, unless Representative Ward wants a final word, which I think you kind of just had, but you want to say one more
word? It's a good bill. Vote for it.
All right, thank you. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Yes.
Vice Chair Moran. Representative Moran. Representative Mack.
No.
Representative Abler. Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Benson.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Fritz.
Yes.
Representative Gruenhagen.
No.
Representative Huntley.
Yes.
Representative Clark Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Morgan.
Aye.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Schoen.
Yes.
Representative Shoemaker.
No.
Representative Ward.
Aye.
Yes.
Oh. Sorry, Representative Zerwas.
No.
Did both wards vote?
There being 12 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed to government operations. Thank you, Representative Ward.
Madam Chair.
So, members, we are going to stand in recess till the call of the chair, and we will reconvene approximately 6 p.m. Now, listen, it's not the same room. 300 South. Okay, we will meet in 300 South. At 6 o'clock p.m. So we stand in recess.
All right, we will come back to order after our recess, and Ms. Sando is getting some copies made of an amendment that for the next bill. We're going to take up House File 1117, but without her here, I'm not ready to move, or Representative Huntley will move his bill, but not quite yet because she's not here to record it. But in the interest of time, why don't we just get started, Representative Huntley, if you would just start by describing your bill, and we'll do that, and then when she gets here, we'll move it.
And I have Mr. Kerver from the Department of Human Services, the Inspector General. That's the, so watch out what you say.
He's pretty powerful.
This bill has to do with methadone. And for those that don't know, methadone is used to treat people that are addicted to heroin, which that was its original use. It's also now used to treat people that are addicted to other opioid kinds of compounds like OxyContin. It has been used for 40, 50 years at least for heroin addiction. And the I will say there's a debate in the medical community about how and when it should be used. And the purpose of this bill is not to get into that fight. Some groups think that methadone should only be used for a short time, and the total abstinence is the only way to go. Other parts, good providers in our healthcare community think that your addiction is a lifetime disease and it can be treated with methadone, and so you should take methadone for the rest of your life. For some people, they've been on it for years and years and years, lead very productive lives and seem to handle it very well. There is a problem, however, and that is that some of the clinics that distribute methadone to mainly the heroin addicts don't regulate very well what they're doing. And Representative Abler, when he was chair, had a hearing on this last December, I think.
Yeah.
It is a major problem, and it's the people. In fact, there was one clinic in Duluth. All they do is a methadone, and they were giving the people stuff, and the people would take it out in their parking lot and sell it right outside the door. And so some of the clinics were not doing a good job of keeping this
under control. Other clinics do a fine job. And so this bill is to try to stop what's called the diversion of methadone from the patients that are supposed to get it to having it sold or whatever to other people. And it is a major problem in the state, but on a per capita basis, it is the city of Cloquet is the highest per capita misuse of methadone, methadone deaths in the state on a per capita basis. And some of it in the Cloquet area revolves around the tribe and tribal problems with this. And the tribe is very interested in putting an end to this, so it's not that kind of an issue. There was a very serious case where two people from Cloquet that were supposed to be getting methadone drove to the clinic in Brainerd and were driving back, and apparently the driver had IV'd some of the liquid methadone, which they're not supposed to IV, and smashed into a car carrying, or a truck carrying, two county highway workers and killed them. So that got a lot of attention last fall. So the purpose of this bill is to stop the diversion. It's not to stop methadone treatment prescribed by a physician. It's to simply put some controls under on it so it does not get diverted and sold on the street to other individuals. And the Senate passed this when, yesterday?
Yep.
We have an amendment that gets the bill identical to what the Senate passed, except they added another little section on marijuana-like compounds, which I support putting it on there, but I don't think it applies to this bill, so I'm not going to put that amendment on. But the amendment that I will offer when the time comes simply gets the bill identical with the Senate bill. Mr. Kerber can explain the bill. We also have a couple of providers that will come up and say that they support the bill. The original bill was somewhat controversial with some of the providers, but they, I think, are all on board right now. So Mr. Kerber did a lot of work with them to get this amendment that they would approve. So if you want to...
Okay,
yes,
well,
Mr. Kerber.
Thank you, Representative Huntley, and Ms. Sando's back, so I think at this point, we can. Yeah. She's got to get her computer all up and running here, but I think that you could move your bill now, Representative Huntley.
I would move that House File 1117 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay. Representative Huntley moves that House File 1117 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. And then Representative Huntley moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which he would like it to be discussed.
Well, right. I move the A1 amendment.
All right. So all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Motion prevails, and we've adopted the A1. So, Representative Huntley or Mr. Kerber, maybe you want to walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm from the Department of Human Services as the head of the Inspector General's Office. And within the Inspector General's Office, one of the branches is the Licensing Division. And so the Licensing Division is the area of DHS that oversees and regulates chemical dependency treatment programs, and including these methadone treatment programs. And I just want to thank Representative Huntley for authoring this bill. This is we have seen, as he mentioned, an increasing problem throughout the state related to methadone treatment programs. There are about 5,000 people in the state who are receiving methadone treatment, about 55% of them are publicly funded, and it's a growing. It's a growing industry, this treatment, and we're not, as Representative Huntley said, we're not debating the issue of whether methadone treatment is appropriate, because there are very differing opinions, and there's very good scientific discussion of that. But what clouds that discussion, unfortunately, is when there are community issues related to the methadone treatment program that become the focal point. And unfortunately, they assist people in coming to conclusions about the appropriateness of methadone treatment as an alternative, as a treatment approach, when these programs have not been necessarily good community members. And so it's kind of with that vein that we have worked very closely with providers. And as Representative Huntley indicated, when the bill was first introduced, there were multiple points in the bill that were not really well received by the provider community, and we have worked very closely with them, and some of them are here tonight, and will indicate that we've kind of come to an understanding on many of these provisions, on actually all the bill. And so we're very glad to have been able to work with them closely, and the bill is much better because of it. We have 16 programs throughout the state that provide this kind of treatment. Two of them are residential treatment programs, and the others are outpatient. And they're in St. Cloud, Rochester, Brainerd, Duluth, Wilmer, and the rest are in the metro area. And that presents some problems regarding relative to the long distances that some people need to travel. And at the department, we're going to be working on that over the next year and with providers to figure out how can we make this kind of treatment more accessible so that we won't have people driving from Cloquet to Brainerd to get their takeout methadone. There are just too many issues related to that, as well as the transportation costs that we're paying for many of these people. And so there's a lot of work to be done in this area. One of the things that we encountered when we've had a big increase in the number of complaints that we get about methadone treatment programs that we've been investigating over the last couple of years, and it's come to our attention that the structure of the regulatory system for these programs was really pretty flawed. If you think about it, it's a pie with five pieces, and one set of regulatory standards were enforced by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Another is by the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA. Another one is by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration of the federal government. And then they also required providers, as a condition for licensure, that they have to have certification from an accrediting agency. And then the fifth slice of that pie would be the Department of Human Services. And there's very little overlap in that. And that's normally how we like our licensing standards to be, is so that there's not duplication. But with so many regulatory agencies and so many different organizations having responsibility, it sort of diffused it, and so ultimately sort of nobody today has real good accountability for monitoring compliance of these programs and holding them accountable, and most importantly responding well to community incidents and concerns from patients, from families, from neighbors, from law enforcement, from the county. And so that's what our proposal does here, is that for the most part there aren't a lot of new expectations. There's a few, and we can talk about those. But for the most part, it's taking a look at those federal requirements that are already in place and putting those in state law so that we're going to be enforcing them. And they're in many of these important areas regarding diversion control and of this methadone that's dispersed, and also the take-home medication. So I'll go through this bill, Madam Chair, and I would be willing to go to any level of detail people want, depending on how much time you have. But maybe I'll just start by kind of going through it, and it's so it would be as the amended version would look. The first section is dealing with information that's provided to people who are admitted to treatment programs. In the original bill, we had a provision that said that when somebody's admitted to a methadone treatment program, they had to be given information about the other treatment options that are available to them. And while the methadone treatment providers, you know, weren't categorically opposed to that notion, they said, well, you know, it should be broader than that, and that anybody with an opiate addiction who is admitted to any chemical dependency treatment program really ought to be given the same information so that they can make an informed decision about what kind of treatment they want to partake. And so in order to do that, what we worked out is that there's a role for the Department of Human Services in this. Where there is information to be given on this somewhat controversial topic, In order for the same information to be given to people kind of across the system, it makes sense for the Department of Human Services to develop like a pamphlet of information they'll be given out. And so that's a requirement that we're putting in here for all chemical dependency treatment programs. When they encounter somebody who's being admitted to their program for an opiate addiction, that they would provide that same information. The next part of it just kind of makes it clear that where there are, as I mentioned, that we're trying to kind of duplicate federal requirements, and sometimes those change. And so there's a comfort provision here that makes it clear that if the federal government is really getting clear on a particular interpretation, that's what we're going to go with in Minnesota too. But that is what we will enforce. We aren't just going to rely on the federal government to enforce it. Some of the areas seem a little obvious. Like we are putting in our licensing statute who can order the medication. And that's where, you know, that's one that was sort of borrowed from the Board of Pharmacy in Chapter 152 that identifies controlled substances in Minnesota. It says that only a physician can order Schedule II narcotics. Well, we had, unfortunately, in one of our programs, we had licensed chemical dependency counselors ordering methadone and changing the doses. And, you know, and not necessarily to good end. And so what we're kind of bringing that into our licensing standards. So we'll be monitoring to make sure that physicians only are ordering this stuff. And then with that, also, we have encountered situations where there's no documentation of who ordered it. And the excuse was that, well, it was a telephone order. And so we're saying, well, telephone orders are a legitimate part of the healthcare industry. We all know that. But where it's a telephone order, it has to be signed off on by the physician in 72 hours. So it's kind of an example of how, you know, we're getting kind of specific on a number of things, but we're not necessarily reinventing these standards. They exist elsewhere, too. We're going to be requiring, our standards will duplicate the federal requirements regarding random drug testing. That's one of the things that we've discovered hasn't been done regularly in some of the programs where there are problems. People are going to get 8 random tests in a 12-month period. The take-home medication, we have some clarification of standards regarding that. There are criteria that need to be met for somebody to be eligible to take medication home. So the default is that if I'm getting methadone as a treatment, because of the sort of the enhanced risk of misuse of that kind of medication, the default is that I have to go to the clinic every day and get my methadone and take it there. Obviously, that's quite a burden for people. And so the goal is to get people more independent from that daily visit to the clinic. And so, but in order to be eligible for that, there are eight points. It's an 8-point criteria that's identified in federal law that we're repeating back in our state law that we'll be enforcing. And it has to do basically with how stable and predictable people are and whether they can store the medication safely in their house and, you know, they're actively participating in treatment and there's no sign that they're abusing drugs. Then after that, we get into restrictions related to the limits. And so how much medication can people take home? And there again, there's federal guidelines for that that we're repeating in our state law, so that when we get reports about, for instance, a methadone clinic is within the very short period of time giving people enormous amounts of takeout medication, and as Representative Huntley said, there were other reports that they were simply selling it not even beyond the parking lot. You know, we want to have a little bit better control, and we'll be able to monitor for that. So I won't get into those details beyond that, but we can talk about it if you like. We have a section that deals with guest dosing, and that's the practice where if I'm getting methadone on a regular basis from my clinic, but I'm going to be out of town, and I'm still going to need that methadone, and I'm not at a point where I can get enough of that methadone to take with me out of town, I have to make an arrangement with another clinic to go there when I'm out of town, into that town, to get the methadone. And so there's some, you know, we have standards for that again, are consistent with the federal requirements. An area that we made some changes, again, based on our extensive meeting and working these things out with providers, is related to how much counseling people should get in addition to the methadone. And this is an area where there are differing opinions. But what we landed on here is that we think it's very important that people get at least 1 hour a week for the first 10 weeks of admission to a methadone treatment program. And then they get an hour a month thereafter. And so that's what we'll be enforcing. Right now, there's an expectation that they provide counseling as necessary, but there's no minimum amount. And so, unfortunately, in some of these places, there hasn't been any provided. And so this is going to be a new expectation for some, but not for others. And it was interesting working with providers and who are, you know, basically who are identifying these standards are very consistent with what they do. And so when we're very consistent as licensing standards with the providers are doing a good job, it's an easier sell, I think, because what we're trying to do is to bring the others up to where the good ones are. One of the big changes here is in relation to the prescription monitoring program, and I'm not sure how much members know about the prescription monitoring program, but it's maintained by the Board of Pharmacy, and it's a database that they have that has a required participation by pharmacies. So when pharmacies are filling medications, scheduled medications, they have to report to the Board of Pharmacy's prescription monitoring program that medication was given to that person. The idea then is that treating physicians, as they're writing prescriptions for medications, will check against that to see if they're writing a prescription for oxycodone, they're going to be checking to see whether or not this person had a prescription for oxycodone filled yesterday or the day before, and how many physicians they have gone to for that. And so it's really controlling the misuse. It's a voluntary checking right now by physicians, and what this bill does is it makes it required for methadone treatment programs on admission, and then quarterly they have to check against the prescription monitoring database to see if these people are getting any medications that would be of concern. If they are, in that quarterly check, they see that there's something they're of concern, then they have to step it up and do a monthly check. But the second part of that that we're working on is a different approach than the original bill said that the Department of Human Services was going to be required to ask the federal government for a waiver or a variance to the longstanding federal confidentiality requirements. There's a separate set of law by the federal government where they're very protective of information indicating that somebody is in a treatment program for chemical dependency. And it's been around since the early 70s, and you know and people really hang on to that as being very important. It's not only important to protect people's privacy, but you know, as we talk about these things, it's also seen as if that information were opened up to more people, the willingness for people to participate in treatment would diminish. And so we would have more people across the board, really, but in these cases, very seriously, we'd have people who are not getting the treatment that is very effective for them for their opiate addiction. And, you know, and Representative Huntley mentioned that there are some people who are functioning at very high levels in society who are taking methadone on a daily basis. Most of those people have been in the program for years, and they're getting 30 days supply at a time, and they're in all occupations. And so, it's worthwhile, I think, to recognize the privacy there. So what we're doing instead, what we're proposing here, is that the variance we were going to request was that methadone treatment programs would also report to the prescription monitoring program. We're requiring in the bill that they check against the prescription monitoring program when they're ordering these narcotics, but we were going to be requiring that they also that they report the fact that this methadone is prescribed to these people, reporting that to the pharmacy monitoring program. But that's not what we're going to do now. What we're going to do is the Department of Human Services is going to, on a regular basis, check against the prescription monitoring program ourselves. And so we have we get the names of everybody who is admitted to a methadone treatment program, and that's part of a registry system, so that if somebody's admitted to a program, we do a quick check to see are they also admitted to another methadone treatment program at the same time. And sometimes there are attempts, but so then we intervene in those cases. But because we have that same information, we're setting up a system with the Board of Pharmacy where we will do a check against the prescription monitoring program to see whether or not any of these people who are currently enrolled in a methadone treatment program are also getting multiple prescriptions or they have multiple prescribers indicated in that database. And then simply we will not be making any judgments about that, but we'll notify the methadone treatment program that there's somebody that this person is somebody they need to check out in the prescription monitoring program. And so it kind of gets at, I think, the outcome of that the at least the methadone treatment programs are going to know when one of their clients is getting medications elsewhere. Another section here that I'm pretty excited about is a quality improvement plan. Methadone treatment programs, through their certification or their accreditation, have to have a quality assurance system in place, and we're actually requiring that too. And you know, that's nice to see as a regulator when somebody has a plan in place where they're kind of monitoring their own performance on a bunch of variables, and when they discover problems, they have a loopback system to fix it, monitor whether their fix was adequate. In here, what were the two areas that are really significant for the problems that we've been having is that they have to have a part of their quality management program has to include their monitoring the premises of the program in and around parking lots, what's going on, and set up a plan for how they're going to monitor how their program is operating within that community. And then address problems. And another area is they have to reach out and develop a positive relationship with local law enforcement, with county social services. So we're going to be requiring, essentially, they have some plan in place so that they're good community members.
Mr. Kerber, are we just about through?
Yep,
because
Madam
I think
Chair,
we have some. I think we have Representative Huntley. Did you have other testifiers?
We have a couple, I think. But they're going to be very, very
good. Okay, yeah. Can you just wrap up for us?
Madam Chair, I will. I think the only other thing to say is that the information that the department is going to generate, the educational information about treatment and treatment options for people with opioid addictions, is also going to be a requirement for people making placement decisions. So the county assessors who are making referrals are going to be required to provide that same information to the person they're doing the assessment of and explaining to them, these are your treatment options and here's the risks and benefits of it. And the information is provided by our agency. I guess in summary, I'm just going to say that we had this bill. We think is going to do a pretty good job. It's a good start for addressing some of the problems that we've had with methadone treatment programs throughout the state. In that, it'll allow us to do a better job of responding to complaints that we get, and allow us to do a better job of overseeing them and making sure that the services are good.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kerber. We have somebody else who wants to testify on the bill.
Thank you.
Welcome to committee.
Hello. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my voice is a little weak. I've got a bit of a cough, so I apologize. My name is Fred Olerking. I represent Hennepin County Medical Center Addiction Medicine Program. And I want to express my support for the amendment. We all are aware of the tragedies that have happened over the last year, and we're very saddened by them. And we feel that these incidents reflect badly on all the programs and our patients. But I want to assure you that most of our patients are invisible. As Inspector Kerber mentioned, there are over 5,000 patients in the state. And at HCMC, we've had a methadone program for 20 years. And I still have to provide directions to our clinic when I'm talking to staff. So there are a lot of patients that are simply invisible because they're doing what they need to do. They're coming to the clinic, they're leaving, they're going home and leading their lives. We feel that this amendment and this bill can go a long way into creating a safer treatment environment for our patients and for the community. The original bill, as it was presented, had some problems, but to DHS's credit, Inspector Kerber met with the treatment providers and had a very cooperative effort to make some changes that I think makes this a very strong bill and can really improve the safety of the community. We are in a very complex regulatory environment, as Inspector Kerber mentioned, DEA, Board of Pharmacy, Joint Commission, CARF, and DHS. And one of the things that this bill does is it works to take some of the federal regulations and incorporate them in the state law and make them more easily enforced. In addition to that, the bill, as amended, does some of the following things. It provides patients with an opportunity for education about their treatment choices.
And excuse me, Doctor, but I think we don't need to go over the same ground that Mr. Kerber covered, and I don't know if that's where you're going, but, you know, it's okay if you don't do that.
Okay, all right, no problem.
We're a very big time.
No problem. All right, absolutely no problem. Just want to, this is the second time I've been confused for a physician. I'm not a physician, just by the way, I want to state that.
Okay.
I'm a psychologist and a licensed alcohol drug counselor. I got this last night at the Senate meeting as well. And I've been teased about it all day. So
the teasing continues.
Yes, we'll continue, no doubt. So I guess in the summation, then I'll just say that we're very happy with the outcome. I think the nice thing about this has been an opportunity to cooperate with DHS, and I think it will lead to further opportunities to provide more clear guidance to the providers and to be able to work well with them. So
all right.
I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, any questions from members? I'm not seeing any. So that being the case, Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 1117, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much,
Madam
Representative
Chair, and thank
Huntley.
You members.
Seem to have lost Representative Abel.
It's my decide file. Just give you yours too.
Just pause for a couple of minutes here. I think Mr. Bergeron went to find him, and then we will take up House File 1114.
No, they didn't do that.
Problem, Representative Abler.
Okay.
Okay. So we have before us 1114. Representative Abler is going to move that House File 1114 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Exactly, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Representative Abler, you have.
I'd like to move the DE. Actually, it's something. It's
the 0104.
The 0104. Then I have an amendment to the amendment, which I want to just offer.
Is that a
offer.
Written one, or are you just incorporating
it? Oh, no, it's a big one. I'd like to move the A1, which is an amendment to the
Okay.
amendment.
Well, maybe then we should adopt the 0104.
No, you don't want to adopt the 0104.
No?
I mean, trust me, you want to adopt the A1 first, and then we'll adopt the
Okay. A1. All right. Okay. So we're going to adopt. Now, is the A1 then to the...
It's
to the DE.
Yes, the DE. And let me explain it, Madam Chair, so
okay,
you know what you're
please.
Doing. And this is a department bill, and the bulk of it is department things, and there's a few other topics that you're going to hear about tonight. In its original proposal, this has to do with background studies and licensing and OIG stuff and whatever, which you'll hear about in the content of it. The more controversial section includes permanent bars and disqualifications. The department was proposing giving everybody who had a set aside before 2005, I think was your proposal, let them get a variance. And a variance is not as good as a set aside, and later you're going to learn about that. The staff will tell you all about the differences in a shorter time than I could. So we're proposing that going forward people could get set asides. However, we're excluding from that population people with sex crimes and murderers and manslaughterers. And so the A1 amendment actually removes from this consideration any of those people who are listed, which is a relatively not nice bunch. And so they shouldn't have done those things, and I'm not helping them today. So that, Madam Chair, this amendment would actually take out the people who are enumerated on here from consideration for a set-aside.
Okay, so Representative Abler, then, so what's in the DE amendment includes these people that you want to take out, right?
Correct.
Okay, I get that. Now, the problem I think we have is that the DE isn't before us, so we can't amend it. So I think we can incorporate...
We can amend an amendment. Then.
Well, but it's not before us. We can let's incorporate the A1.
Yeah,
I think
right.
We can incorporate that into the DE.
Yes, right? I would like to incorporate it, Madam Chair.
Right? Council, can I do that, staff? I can incorporate it into Mr. Bergeron stepped out.
I can.
But I think we can incorporate into, an author can incorporate something
right,
into
sir.
His amendment. So we're going to incorporate, Representative Abler is incorporating the A1 into the 0104 amendment. So,
right.
To which it's drafted.
And then if you want to vote on that, then the bill is much more tame than it was before
And then when we vote on that, we'll be voting on the 0104, the DE amendment,
right.
As amended.
By A1.
And putting that on the bill.
Right.
So is everybody okay with that and understand what we're doing? Okay, Representative Johnson, you look puzzled.
I may not know exactly what we're doing, but I'm okay with it.
I'm in a journal about that.
Okay, so we are going to vote then. Are there any questions? Well, we're going to put this bill in the order in which the author wants to discuss it. And so we're going to be voting on the 0104 amendment as amended, or incorporating these changes, incorporating the A1. So all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay.
And so Madam Chair, the department has an amendment. I'd like them to describe it to you. Do you want to talk about this one? 210 or...
And do you want to do that before we discuss?
Yeah, I think we'll just get it all squared away. And
okay.
It's from the department.
Okay.
So maybe it's just part of the discussion.
Amendment are we?
Madam Chair, I'll move the 0210 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Abler moves the 0210. And do you want to describe that? Somebody describe it?
We're deciding who's going to do that.
Okay. It's actually part of the whole presentation, and this is the first committee of its stop, so it's appropriate, but I think it's say what it is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer-Zaroski with the Department of Human Services, Office of Inspector General Licensing Division, and this amendment actually amends a couple of different provisions in the delete all. I could address those as we go through those sections, if you like, or just highlight those three sections at this time.
I think probably since Representative Abler says this is kind of part of the whole way he's getting this in order, I think we could just vote on this unless members have, and then we can discuss it as a package unless members have issues with it or questions to the 0210 amendment. Okay, then. All in favor of the 0201 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, the rest of the amendments are for later, so we'll let the department present their bill, and then we'll talk about, given the last confusion about author's amendments and non-author's author's amendments,
yes,
we'll just do the bill, Madam Chair.
Appreciate that, Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer's Rust. again. This bill, the Office of Inspector General bill, amends a number of provisions. It contains Human Services Licensing Act changes, Human Services Background Studies Act changes. It includes fraud, abuse, and prevention changes. It includes some changes to the chemical health rate enhancement area and data practices. So I will highlight each of those briefly, starting with data practices, which is Article 1.
I'm Vicki Quinert, and I'm also with the Department of Human Services in the Office of Inspector General. The first Section 1 in Article 1 amends the investigative data in Subdivision 3. Currently, the statute allows that when we have an open investigation, the fact of our investigations can be public information. We are modifying this language so that when even disclosure of the fact of the investigation might compromise the investigation, we are asking for language that we can limit the disclosure if it determines that it would compromise the investigation. Already in this past year, we have had experience to be concerned that even identifying the fact of an investigation for a provider could threaten and disrupt the investigation itself.
Then Section 2 does three things related to the Human Services licensing data. There's a specific provision that governs licensing data. The first is that we issue orders of temporary immediate suspension. That's the most serious sanction that we issue. And that usually is going to be, the sanction itself is public, but anything to do with why we issued it is confidential because it's under investigation. And what this would do is provide that the general nature of the matter under investigation would indeed be public data at the time of issuance of the sanction. The second piece is the fact that there are settlement negotiations underway would be public data. Right now, those are not public data, and what happens with those is they can be protracted settlement negotiations pending the hearing on a matter. So that would be public. And then the third is, currently under the law, when a license holder or an applicant is the individual that is found responsible for maltreatment or disqualification, and then we issue a licensing sanction, that's public data. What we're doing is adding a controlling individual to that as well. So if a controlling individual is responsible for maltreatment, say, then that would be public data. So those are all of the data practices provisions.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I see a new term here entered in, and that's the controlling individual, and I don't see a definition. Could you just tell us what a controlling individual is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a definition of controlling individual in 245A02. It's not in the bill before you, but basically a controlling individual, and it's kind of a long definition, but we're talking about someone who has a managerial direction responsibility, ownership responsibility. Those are some of the key components of a controlling individual.
Thank you.
All right, then I'll go with the licensing provisions. There's a number of sections. Many of the licensing provisions are rather technical and in terms of being clarification. Oftentimes over the interim we have matters that come up that, well, this should be clearer. So that's what a lot of people are doing here. I will go through them briefly section by section to try to keep it brief. It is sort of a long bill. So Section 1 actually is amending the Child Care Assistance Statute, and this provides for legal non-licensed providers that the CPR training must include techniques for infants and children, if indeed infants are being served. There are a couple of other child care provisions in here, but I'll just note that most of the child care provisions this session are in a budget bill, in a separate budget bill. The second piece actually relates to what we were just talking about with the definition of controlling individual. It's clarifying that definition to say that, for instance, child care centers directors are not a controlling individual. If they do not have that ownership interest or they don't have that control of management of the overall agency, then they are not a controlling individual. And that's necessary to clarify, for example, if a child care center director is an employee and they are found responsible for maltreatment, but they're not the owner, the managerial official, it would not be public data. in terms of that piece. Section 3 requires the applicants to provide their federal employer tax ID and also to provide any of their names that are registered with the Secretary of State, as well as any assumed names registered. And this is to get at who we're dealing with in terms of the applicant. Last year we did require the state tax ID but didn't include the federal employer ID. Again, I'm just going to highlight these and not get into too many of the very, very technical ones. Section 4 clarifies that license holders have to provide access to the personnel records of current and former staff to DHS for our investigations. Section 5 is purely a technical amendment to be consistent with the Department of Education statute regarding their on-site children residential programs. Section 6 provides for the issuance of a conditional license when a disqualified individual has been ordered and immediately removed, but they continue to be affiliated with the program. And this is one of the first amendments that was mentioned before. And the amendment, we got some input on a couple of these that they could be clearer in terms of what does affiliated mean, and that was really good input. And so what we did is basically defined what does that mean, and it means in this case that there's a family or a household member or another individual who has a record of having access to the children in care, that if they have a disqualification that's not set aside, there could be a conditional license issued. Section 7 amends the temporary immediate suspension standard to add as a basis continued noncompliance. Again, we got input that was rather vague. And so we're trying to clarify that and saying if what happens is we have programs that we revoke their license and they have their due process to continue operating. And unfortunately, sometimes they continue to have rule violations, statutory violations. And so what we're defining here is that if there is a new violation that could impact the health and safety of individuals, that could form the basis for a temporary immediate suspension, which would mean their license would be taken away right away before the hearing. They still have all of their hearing and due process rights. Section 8 is a technical cross-reference to the Revenue Recapture Act rules. That's the rules that govern our contested cases, and they're mentioned everywhere, but in this section it wasn't clear. And then Section 9 is also the third area where there was an amendment that was referenced earlier. And what we're doing here in the contested cases is we're specifying timelines for those contested case hearings. Only right now, temporary immediate suspensions, the expedited hearings have a timeline. We're specifying hearings for all, timelines for all hearings now. And we were given input that this was favorable, but that we need to make sure we allow for those cases in which there's a pending criminal matter or a juvenile matter to allow that extension. Because what happens in these hearings, a lot of times if there's a pending criminal matter, the parties want to wait until the outcome of that criminal matter to proceed with the administrative matter. Section 10 amends the scope of the contested case hearing to just clarify that the request for reconsideration must be timely. Section 11 clarifies that the addition of a new applicant, when we have applicants, if their license application is denied, if one of those goes and applies for a license with someone else, that subsequent license, they're also bound by that.
I'm just everybody's coming and going.
Oh, okay. And then Sections 12 and 13, this is one of the child care ones that is in this bill. And what this is doing is amending the child care crib standards and the documentation standards for those to be consistent to comport with the federal standards. There are federal standards that govern that. And then Section 15 clarifies that in child care, family child care, the rules that govern those services also apply to the provider's own children if they're of the age within the scope of the rule, under the age of 10. For instance, counted in the capacity during the hours of operation. And then Sections 16 and 17 specify a time period for a current requirement for a license holder completion of an internal review under maltreatment of minors and vulnerable adults law, and this is just specifying that time period for completing that already required review. And then sections 18 through 24 and repealer deal with amendments that were passed last session that related to what is a budget proposal this session. Last session standards passed to regulate home and community-based services under a single set of standards across the state, and that was required by the CMS Corrective Action Plan. The standards for Phase 1 were passed, but the fee was not passed, and this session we're coming forward with a budget proposal for a cost recovery methodology for those, as well as the Phase 2 standards. So what this does is restores that language to the other statute that will be repealed. 245B will be repealed when 245D becomes effective. I'm trying to keep that simple, but basically what happened is license holders told us we don't want to have to change what we're doing under 245B for just a short time if we're going to have to change it again under 245D, and we agreed that the intent was it would be all done at once. So that concludes the Licensing Act amendments.
Okay. Any questions, members, on that section?
Madam Chair, continuing with Article 3, these are the financial fraud and abuse sections. The first and fourth section deal with authorizing the department to have the option of using unmarked cars for our investigation. One takes care of the side door markings, and one takes care of the license plates. This is to protect investigators conducting surveillance investigations. It is for our investigators in central office and also the investigators at the county level that we support through our fraud prevention investigation grants. They particularly asked that we get this authorization to protect not only the actual surveillance happening during the investigation, but also the investigators themselves. Section 2 deals with an expansion from language that passed last session. Last session, in Chapter 171, we got authorization for the facial recognition project, which is a joint project between our department and the Department of Public Safety. Several years back, the Department of Public Safety received a grant and used special facial recognition data using digitalized photos and looked at their database of driver's license and found the same face on multiple driver's license. Initially, when they applied this software, they found over a million hits of the same face on multiple driver's license. After working the data for, I think it must have taken a couple years or longer, they got rid of all the people that legitimately changed their names, have a cousin that looks alike, sisters, brothers, married name changes, and all those things. And they've culled it down to probably about 15,000 that we will be receiving. This goes into effect this summer. What this amendment does is expand the data we will receive to make sure that we not only receive the usual data on a driver's license, but that we will receive the photo as well. Our task is to make sure that we get the same name with more than one driver's license that they couldn't account for through legitimate means, that we make sure that one face, that one person, doesn't have more than one public benefit account in multiple counties. That's our work. So that's what that language will do. And Section 3 expands our authority to access employment data through deed. And as I said, with the DPS, they certainly support the language we put in Section 2, and deed supports the language we're putting in Section 3. This gives us a bit more expansion of authority to access payroll information, particularly when we are investigating providers.
Any questions? Thank you. The next article.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer's Rest again. Article 4 is one section, chemical and mental health, and this one section provides clarification regarding the rate enhancement requirements for chemical dependency programs. The licensing division monitors for rate enhancement for programs. For example, if a program serves co-occurring conditions, for example, chemical dependency with mental health needs. This particular amendment addresses documentation needed to verify that and specifically focuses on another type of rate enhancement where chemical dependence programs, excuse me, some of them have parents with children attending the program, and so then, of course, any child care requirements are also relevant to that program. So it's clarifying the documentation. Then I'll move on to, if there are no questions on that one, I'll move on to Article 5, which is the background studies, Human Services background studies provisions. And similar to the Human Services Licensing Act, a number of these are clarifying in nature, areas that needed clarified that were identified over the interim. So I'll try to keep it brief and go through that section by section as well. Section 1 changes the timeline for submission of another study request from 90 days to 120 days. Last session, we changed it from 45 to 90 days and received some input, particularly from Head Start programs, that wasn't long enough. And so this is when, say, an employee is gone from employment for whatever reason, a leave of absence, and then comes back. This will provide that after 120 days, then they'll have to have another study. Section 2 clarifies that upon request, law enforcement agencies are required to provide arrest and investigative data. Some read the may to be discretionary in terms of the list, and it was meant to pertain to the list. So it is a clarification. Section 3 has to do with when the commissioner has reasonable cause to believe the identity of a subject is uncertain. Again, clarifying that we may require fingerprints. Section 4 clarifies that this initial risk of harm that we does not apply to PCA agencies because their studies have to be completed all the way through before they can work. Section 5 requires a license holder to document in an employee's file the date of the first direct contact with persons in addition to the date the program initiated the study, which is current law. Section 6 clarifies the timeline for the commissioner's response to a request for consideration begins from the date of a complete request. Section 7 amends the subdivision to require what happens is when we do that initial risk of harm and advise the individual of the right to request reconsideration, then they're notified that, say, if they're high risk, they're ordered immediately removed. If they're moderate level risk, they're ordered under continuous supervision, and then low risk, there is no supervision ordered. This is saying then that at the reconsideration stage, if they were ordered immediately removed, that does remain in place. But if they were not ordered under continuous supervision or immediately removed pending a hearing right, they will be under continuous supervision at that point in time pending their hearing. Section 8 clarifies requirements relating to permanent bars and set-asides, and Representative Abler did talk about some related provisions there earlier. In addition to those, this provision does two changes to the permanent bars. And what permanent bars are permanent disqualifications, and that's what Representative Abler was speaking about. A permanent bar means that the individual is barred from having a set-aside or a variance, which means they cannot be in a position working with individuals or having access. And in 2005, there were a number of provisions that removed discretion for the commissioner to allow the department to set aside or grant a variance. What this does is reinstates some of that discretion in two ways. First, the department will be able to... sorry about that. I was just advised that section's been amended out.
Yes, the other earlier amendment.
Okay, we'll work on this then.
Never mind.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for that. There is no change to the permanent bars, just the permanent disqualifications.
As is in the amendment.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Section 9 amends the scope of the contested case hearing provision to specify that a request for reconsideration of a maltreatment or disqualification must be timely to be included. And then Section 10 clarifies the contested case hearing requirements. The rest of the provisions, 11 and 12, comport with that cross-reference to the fair hearing statute regarding the scope of the hearing and when matters are conclusive. And that concludes the background studies provisions.
So, Madam Chair, if there's questions on this part, this would be a good time for those. Then we'll go to other topics.
I know people have really paid attention word by word. Any questions? If not, let's continue on. There were some additional amendments or other issues you wanted to raise.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Allen had an amendment, and I have to see her here. Zachary Pate is here. This is, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, and then I'll call a witness up to describe this.
Thank you. Representative Faber moves the H1114A2 amendment. Have that, and you can explain
it. And it deletes one word and adds two, so it's amazing what value that can have to a group.
Good evening.
Committee.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I will also be very brief with my comments and explain what is an important and yet very straightforward amendment. And I
if
want to
you
just
could first just introduce yourself for the record.
I can certainly do that. I'm Kate Zacherpate. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And the Board of Social Work is the agency that's responsible for the licensing and the regulation of all the social workers in Minnesota. And I just want to, first of all, though, really thank Representative Allen, who sponsored the bill, Representative Johnson, who was also a co-signer, and Representative Abler for his support throughout. This is a real partnership, this bill that's come before you tonight. It is non-controversial. This bill is supported by the tribal organizations in Minnesota, the Board of Social Work, Department of Human Services, and NAMI. So it really is a non-controversial partnering kind of approach. And it doesn't create any new licensing requirements, but what it does is that it simply allows tribal agency social workers to be recognized, as you can see in the amendment, as eligible agency personnel during the current grandfathering that is going on with the Board of Social Work. Some of you may recall that last year there was some legislation that caused some modifications in the current social work licensing exemptions. And at the time, that, of course, did not include any of the tribal agencies or organizations because the board has no jurisdiction over sovereign nations. So they were not included in that bill in terms of any changes, nor were they then identified as an affected sort of agency or setting that would qualify for grandfathering. So the tribal organizations approached the Board of Social Work in January, hoping to be able to move this initiative forward. So that is why we're here. Again, we really do see all the partners involved in this as a win-win for the board, for the tribal organizations, for the citizens of Minnesota. And what we see, too, as expected outcomes and the goals from what, you know, again, I would really suggest is a pretty straightforward change, is that it really does promote voluntary licensure with tribal organizations and tribal members that are really excited about this. We hope that it will increase culturally competent social workers. We hope that it will address some of the great disparities that we are seeing within the American Indian population in Minnesota. We hope that it will create a better service delivery system and basically enhance public protection for the American Indian population within the sovereign nations and tribal organizations. So with that, I would certainly take any questions if there are any, but I really do thank you for your attention, and I hope that you can support this and see this as a win-win.
Thank you, Ms. Zuckerpade.
Yes.
Did I get that right? Thank you very much. Any questions? If not, all in favor of the A2 amendment, vote aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
Very good. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, I have one more amendment that I'm going to offer tonight, and I don't know if there's any testifiers to it. It's the A5 amendment, and I'm not sure if Mr. Kerber is aware of this. You know this amendment? Have you seen this one? To make the world a better place. I'll describe it. You can offer my description. But, Madam Chair, the A5 amendment, the department's very diligent about listing things that have been found wrong, but they don't always get around to saying when you fixed it. There, is that nice? This says you got to write it down when they fixed it. I think Mr. Kerber could offer some more insight, but that's and actually they have to provide a plan. Is that right? It's
Mr.
Madam
Kerber.
Chair, members, yeah. My name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services from the Inspector General's office, and this was an amendment that we've talked about over time with providers our licensing lookup, if you look at the DHS public website, you'll be able to find out a lot of information about many of our license programs. And we're expanding that. So if it's a program that we license directly, you can see not only sort of the directory information about what kind of services do they provide and what are their capacities and where they're located and who are their contact people, but also if it's one of the programs that we license directly, you can see their history of violations. We post the documents that we generate and issue to the program. So you'll be able to read correction order letters, investigation summaries of maltreatment, for instance. And if we issue a licensing sanction, you can see that. If there's an appeal of a sanction, we put the outcome of the appeal up there too. What we don't put up there is information that shows how or if or when a provider has corrected those violations that we've made public. And what providers have been asking is that we figure out a way to do that. And so this amendment requires that we figure out a way to do that, and we report back to the legislature in December. And so it's a reasonable thing, and we'll be meeting with and working with provider groups to see if we can come up with a way to document that they have remedied whatever it was that we found to be in violation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just to develop a plan. So I just didn't make them do it, but they like to plan. So they can have meetings and events, and who brings snacks? Is there somebody? Anyway, that's the thing, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Mr. Kerber, I had a question in that right now if someone has done a correction, so they're back in good standing with you, can they call and get that information? Is it publicly disclosed, even if you don't have it on a website?
Madam Chair, yeah, in most cases, I think, you know, I have to admit that the reality is if when we, given workload, if we identify a problem with a provider and we order them to fix it by some timeline, and then to indicate to us that they have done it, we aren't always verifying that they have done it until we make our next licensing visit. And so we're a little hesitant to say, yes, they fixed everything. In some cases, we do know. And so if we do know, we would certainly tell that to the caller because it would be public information. But we don't always know for sure. And so that's one of the things that we'll be working out with the process.
Thank you. Any other questions on the A5 amendment? If not, all in favor of the H114A5 amendment, vote aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The A5 amendment is adopted.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to do a little just short testimony. I know the hour is late, but just on some of the topics. Mark Hasse had to leave, and some people wonder, why are we doing this background stuff, and why would you meddle with this, and, you know, can't they just get a job somewhere else? And there's he left two stories I wanted to read to you. They're short, and I wanted Ms. Hugdahl to just offer her thoughts. And I've been working on this since 2005, and in 2005 we did some necessary cracking down on sex offenders. There were some tragic stories with the Mr. Rodriguez and a woman and Katie Poyer, and so we changed everything. And I think in some cases we carved up some people who were actually not Mr. Rodriguez, and they were rehabilitated, or they were functioning well. 14,000 people were set aside of their disqualification before 2005. and one person reoffended in their area of disqualification. And Mr. Kerber remembers that guy. There were five offenses, and four were unrelated, and they're all minor. There's two people I wanted to tell you about that are the kind of folks that we would like to find a way to help them work. This woman named Julie, probably not a real name, was in an abusive relationship 35 years ago in Nebraska. She'd been hospitalized from his abuse. He was a drug dealer, a bad guy. She was afraid to leave him, so a friend gave her a gun. She ended up shooting him in the leg, she says, accidentally. He didn't press charges, and the case was dismissed. She moved to Minnesota and has had no criminal record since. She was a foster parent for 7 years until she changed agencies and a new background DHS background study was conducted. Based on the police report, DHS determined by a preponderance of the evidence that she had committed first-degree assault and she was permanently disqualified. And so that's one case. A fellow named Richard was a drug addict and was convicted of an aggravated robbery 25 years ago. He learned to paint in prison. After leaving prison, he became a model citizen, has worked finding housing for the homeless, and received numerous awards. He and a friend decided they wanted to teach art classes to kids in a homeless shelter. A DHS background study was required, and he was permanently disqualified from being a volunteer. And how he got around this, he got a pardon in 2012. But getting a pardon is no small matter. And so... And the thing is, and Mr. Kerber is still here, maybe he should come up too, just to tell you how deeply they scrutinize these cases, maybe whatever. So I just want you to know this is not a willy-nilly deal. And so is that an archaic term, Madam
Mr.
Chair?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and members, I'm sorry I just walked back into the room. I didn't hear sort of the preview here.
Well, when you get a request for disqualification from somebody who has a disqualifying crime, you just say, "Oh, that sounds good to us." Or do you have a more thorough process and you turn a lot of them down?
Oh, Madam Chair, members, if somebody requests reconsideration of a disqualification from the department, we have to do a very careful, individualized review of that request. And there are, I think, eight variables that we need to consider that are in statute. We need to look at the length of how many disqualifying factors the person has, how many disqualifying events, how long it's been since they committed those crimes, what was the impact of those crimes on the victim. How similar is the victim to the type of people receiving services where they want to work, and any evidence of rehabilitation. So we need to address all those variables and then make a determination about whether we believe the individual presents a risk of harm to the people receiving services. And as we talked about earlier, there are some individuals who are disqualified who don't get to make that argument to us because they're disqualified for what's called a permanent bar, and it's that list of crimes that was amended here. So those individuals are not able to make that request from us. They can request a reconsideration based on the fact that they believe we got the information wrong, but when it comes to them demonstrating that notwithstanding the fact that I committed that act in my past, today I don't pose a risk of harm and this is why. That's the review we do.
And Representative
Abel. And just briefly, Ms. Hugdahl has got a whole career in these kinds of matters, and I thought that, but she's very young. She started when she was a child. And if she can just maybe just tell you something brief, and then I'm done with my presentation, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, after that introduction, I'm Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid, and I've worked on this issue for several sessions with Representative Abler and many of you over the years, and I just wanted to very briefly hit on a couple of points. And really, when this provision as amended was put together, we really wanted to be sure that what we were doing was saying there are some folks in human services licensing who should just be excluded and not be able to ask for a set-aside, even if the offense was a long time ago. And so we've excluded folks who have been convicted of murder, manslaughter, or any sex crime, essentially, in that list. We do see some cases with folks outside of that list who may have had offenses. Typically, they are long ago. Some of them may have involved chemical dependency issues at those times, things like assault. And so we wanted to have some balance and have discretion. I think the department in the past has been very judicious in using it. And so that was the intent here, was to find the fine line to really recognize the folks, I think, most folks can agree should probably not be working in these fields, and allow some of the discretion back in a reasonable way. This still disqualifies people. The burden is on the person who wants to work if they are not included in the do not pass go list. The burden is on them to prove to the department that they do not pose any risk of harm to be in that particular setting. So just so folks are clear, the offenses that are carved out cannot even ask. We're allowing some folks to come in and say, I am disqualified, I need to prove to you I am not a risk of harm. And if the department grants it, and if the employer still hires them, it allows it in that limited setting for that employer.
Thank you, Ms. Hugda. As you can tell, we have lots of members going in and out for other committee meetings, so we're trying to keep moving along.
Madam Chair, that's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Abler, and Representative Mack has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And we adopted this amendment a little while ago. It was the A130210 amendment. It had to do with the background study. And I guess to whoever could answer the question, I'm just looking for a little bit of history on line 1.3 to 1.8 of that amendment. I think it's referring to a family or household member, if that helps ring a bell. I'm just wondering if you could just give a little history as to the necessity for that.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Mack. Yes, this has to do with actually there was a Court of Appeals case in the interim that addressed this issue, and a license was put on conditional status. We also have the authority to revoke a license if an individual that lives in the household or may have direct contact and has been disqualified, if that disqualification is not set aside, we can revoke. In some cases, we want to issue a conditional license, not revoke. We want to issue a conditional license to say you can keep your license, but we're going to specify conditions, namely that that individual cannot be in the home, say in the family child care home. The Court of Appeals said the law wasn't clear. And so really, that's what this is. And we did receive input to how to make it clear.
Madam Chair.
Representative Max.
So is this addressing a particular individual situation, or is this something that we need to do as requested by the courts? Or is it a widespread problem that we're trying to address?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, it is something that is more widespread than one case that we would want to do this in those cases where it was appropriate instead of revoking. Because we do revoke licenses when there's a disqualification that's not set aside, but it may be in some cases appropriate to grant a conditional.
Okay. And Madam Chair?
Representative Mack.
Thank you. Was this a situation where something... I take it that the Court of Appeals case must be in response to a specific case where something happened, or someone was in a situation they maybe shouldn't have been in because the law wasn't clear, the proper backstops weren't put in place. And so this is responding to a particular case like that. Am I understanding you correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, yes, there was a specific case that did go to the Court of Appeals that involved a disqualified individual.
Okay.
Yes.
And
Representative Mack.
Okay, so then with this fix, trying to understand how it fits in the language and where we're currently at, does this create more protections for potentially children and people that would be in, you know, a situation where there might be a family member there? Are we trying to put more protections in place for people that could be victims of someone with a bad background history, or is this... I'm trying to follow what exactly this is doing. Are we putting more protections into place for vulnerable people, or are we trying to make it more possible for a family or household member that has a disqualification to not to disrupt the business of that provider? Or I don't know if you're following my question. I'm just trying to understand what this is doing, or what kind of cover this is trying to give the department, or what we're trying to do here.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, it is trying to, yes, it's based on affording that protection to children, in the case of family child care, children receiving services.
Okay. And Madam Chair?
Representative Mack.
Could you just explain how, What is this putting into place that protects? If you could just walk me, what protection is this putting into place? If you could just explain it to me.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, and that's a good question because from the amendment you can't see that it's in with the conditional license piece. So we're amending the conditional license statute, that provision that talks about when you grant a conditional license. And this is then clarifying that a conditional license can be issued in these circumstances. And so an example would be, say, an individual that has a family member that, you know, was disqualified, they're required to have a study, and then they moved out. And it really is about the move, what we would call the move-out cases, and that's where the lack of clarity came into play. Well, what if they moved out? And then we would be concerned for the risk of children. They moved out, yes, but they might be just down the road. They're a family member. It's certainly likely that they would come back into the home sometime. And so that's really, so thank you for that question because that really gets at the move out piece is the protection.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my only follow up, and just trying to follow everything that you're saying. I think I've looked or I've asked questions, and so I think I know the answer to this, but just to clarify, if there that is a situation, is there there's requirements of notification, is that correct, if a conditional license has been issued where somebody could, that notifies the parents or notifies whoever saying, listen, this person is a family member of this home, he may or she may come back. Is there notification that is provided to citizens and people so that they understand the situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, there are notification requirements. It's multiple things. So, first of all, an order of conditional license is public data, and it would be posted on our website, as was discussed earlier. In the family child care and child care center area, those child care programs are required to post their licensing sanctions. If there is a case where we have to look at the background studies piece of it, too, because if a disqualification is not set aside, the name of the individual is private data. Okay, so the order would say there's an individual. The individual is not identified. When the individual is identified is if there's a set-aside or variance, which we've talked about just a few minutes ago, too. That means they're going to continue to be in the home. That's public data. And there has to be a notice provided to parents about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Just a closing comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Ayler, before you do your closing comment, I see that we have an A4 amendment that I don't think we've adopted. I don't know if that came from you.
Yeah, it's up to Mullery's, and he's not here, so we're not going to take it up.
He's right behind
Oh, is he
you, but...
Oh, okay. did you want to take it up? I think we're going to skip it. I thought he came and went.
You.
I'm sorry.
Representative Ayler,
but I just want to point out,
ready to go to
good
concluding
joke there,
comments.
But
thank you.
Yeah, my just very last statement. So I've worked with the licensing department of this DHS for, I don't know, a dozen years or something. They're a no-nonsense bunch. And so let me just, when they do their work, a tie goes to the department. They're not interested in people not being certified and qualified. So I'm done, Madam Chair, so we can vote.
Thank you. Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 1114 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services.
Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call, please.
Roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Liebling. Representative Moran.
Yes.
Representative Mack.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Allen. Representative Benson.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Fritz.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Representative Huntley. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Lohmer.
No.
Representative Morgan.
Aye.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Schoen?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Representative Zerwas?
No.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the bill, the motion is passed and the bill is referred.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, next we're going to have House File 1206, Representative Isaacson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And would you like to... I would be glad to move Representative Isaacson's bill, House File 1206, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Isaacson, why don't you tell us about your bill?
You bet. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is just a bill that updates and clarifies body art statutes, looks at imposing a criminal penalty for practicing body art without a license. It's a bill that has the support of the body art community and one that will help us avoid some problems with health issues that come along with body art. And I have a testifier.
Great. Why don't you introduce yourself to the committee? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Duff. I'm a health program representative senior for the Minnesota Department of Health. I am the credentialing and establishment inspection specialist for the body art program. This bill, would you like me to go point by point with
Mr. Duff, it would be helpful if you would explain the bill.
All right, thank you. Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 is basically just a housekeeping issue as far as adding terminology to distinguish that we require establishment licensure for both fixed-site establishments and mobile establishments. There had been a bit of confusion in regards to how that was worded in the current statute. Section 2 is in regards to temporary event permits. This allows a little more flexibility by the department to allow temporary event permits to body artists among the state. This provides us the opportunity to accept applications within the 14 days preceding the event, whereas currently the law will only allow us to accept applications received 14 days or greater. So this is a benefit to the body art community. Section 3 regards the criminal penalty for those who perform body piercings or tattooing without a technician license. We are asking for a penalty of a gross misdemeanor. Section 4 is an amendment to the mandated requirements for aftercare instructions for body art. To include a description of the difference between normal skin irritation and infection. And Section 5 is repealing a method of application that is no longer available regarding the transition period for licensure of body artists.
Thank you, Mr. Duff. Are there any questions for the author or his witness? Thank you. Seeing no hands, I will renew my motion that House File 1206 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair and Committee.
And with that, thank you, everyone, for staying tonight. We are adjourned.